Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hi everyone, this is the 16th episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast. My name is Thomas, I'm a partner with Strategy and your host for this season. We're proud to be back with several new episodes featuring discussions with top-class thought leaders from the healthcare industry. And after having recent conversations with the chief strategy and digital officer of an online pharmacy and a professor of quantitative biomedicine, I'm looking forward to talking to another seasoned strategist within the pharma industry. And today's episode can finally be recorded in a live setting again, and hence I'm more than happy to sit in front of my next guest in a really very nicely refurbished conference room here in Brussels. He describes himself as a scientist by training and philosopher at heart, and I'm really curious to learn more about him and his perspectives in this episode. So please welcome James Sackheim, who kindly agreed to join the Strategy and Insider podcast to discuss his perspectives on the future of health with me today here in Brussels. James is the head of corporate strategy at UCB, which is a global biopharma company headquartered in Belgium. Founded in 1928, UCB focuses primarily on neurology, including epilepsy, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's disease and others, but also immunology disorders such as rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease or psoriasis and others. And by leveraging scientific advances in those areas such as the genetics and biomarkers in human biology, according to their statements. James is, to me, a true primary rock at UCB and already counts more than 17 years at the firm, spanning every aspect of the pharma value chain and lately being responsible for UCB's corporate strategy, as said. His journey with the firm led him from neuroscience and computer science to people management and leadership of complex global projects and launches. And previously, prior to joining, he actually studied neuroscience at the Rutgers University in New Jersey and also obtained a PhD in neuroscience from there. So with all that said, thank you for being here today, James. I'm really very much looking forward to learning more about you, UCB, but also your view on the future of health.
Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to the opportunity and the conversation.
So, hey, James, after all the very relevant lockdown measures that we undergone during the past month, it actually feels really good to sit face to face. And when you personally look back on the pandemic, what for you personally were kind of your major challenges, but also kind of the positive aha moments during that time?
Yeah. Thanks for asking the question. I mean, I feel like this is such a rich topic, right? We'll probably spend the whole podcast just on this one. Yeah. I have a couple of aha moments, I think, and some of them are personal, some of them professional. The one that stands out most for me is around privilege, right? The realization during the pandemic that I was not in a sector of the of industry where my job was at threat from the pandemic, that I was fortunate to not get sick, but also fortunate that if I did, I had support, I had resources, right? Financial security. And for many people, it was a much worse experience than that, not just health-wise, but in terms of anxiety. So for me, that's salient, right?
Yeah.
There's also some beautiful moments that happened, right? Like the best of humanity was shining through in the pandemic, and those were aha moments. There was a particular evening in my neighborhood early on during lockdown when a singer was giving an impromptu concert from her balcony. So she'd dragged the amplifier onto the balcony, and there was a crowd gathering, and she was singing and had a beautiful, like that stuff doesn't happen, unfortunately, anymore or in routine. And it took a pandemic to illustrate it, but it reminded me of the best of humanity and the best of people. There were some tougher ahas, I think, from the pandemic. One of them that impacted me in particular, I suppose, because of my science and philosophy background, is the role that science plays in society. And I think I and maybe a lot of people had spent a long time hoping and wishing that science would play a more prominent role, that more people would be scientifically literate. Mm-hmm. And an aha in the pandemic for me was, be careful what you wish for, maybe, because a little bit of science in the hands of those that maybe aren't well trained in scientific method and how to interpret it, or in the hands of people with a willful agenda rather than an open mind, can actually be highly counterproductive. Yeah. And then, of course, the other more difficult aha was probably around the questions that the pandemic raised in terms of how we value human life, right? So all these public policy decisions where you have to make trade-offs between personal freedom and lockdown, and what's underneath all of them, right, is what, at what length are we willing to go to preserve human life, and would people behave differently depending on which parts of the population are most at risk? So there were real issues at the root of how society deals with health.
The pandemic also sharpened our focus of where to focus, what to decide on, what's really important in life. And I can very much relate to the singer on the balcony, because in where I live, or we live, there was not a singer, but someone who played a trumpet. And he was always going out on a Monday evening at 5 or 6-ish, playing the trumpet for the whole street.
Yeah? That's fantastic.
And people have been listening. And yeah, as you said, this would have never happened. Probably it will not happen again. Yeah. But there is, as you say, good and bad aha moments from that time.
I would love for myself, and I think for all of us, to try and spend a bit more time trying to understand why that doesn't happen. Not why it did happen during the pandemic, but why it doesn't happen today. Like, why won't it happen today?
In normal times, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We would appreciate that as well, I'm sure. You also referenced kind of your combination of being a scientist by training, but also the philosophical part of yourself. How do you think kind of the philosophy that you're interested in, that you're passionate about, does help you excel in your job and what you do every day?
Well, so first, I mean, I appreciate the premise that I excel in my job. I'm not sure I do, but at least I try. But I'm happy to talk about. So I think there's two elements, right?
Yeah.
And again, it links very much to the pandemic and post-pandemic and post-truth era that we're in, right? So a lot of the science that I learned, unfortunately, is a bit out of date, right? Mm-hmm. It was 20-odd years ago for me. But the skills to interpret science, right? The realization, especially in a society that is so information dense, right, and increasingly so, that the realization that everything is really an experiment, right? It's either controlled or not, but almost everything in every day, personally or professionally, is some form of experiment. And there are good and bad experiments with valid and not so valid ways to interpret those results, right? And I think that mindset of being able to interpret what's a valid conclusion to draw, and how much weight can you put on it? That, for me, has been indispensable, mm-hmm. Helping me navigate my career in a lot of different jobs. And equally, philosophy, in a world where, you know, there seems to be more distrust of facts, mm-hmm. right? More ambiguity, more complexity, yet perversely, everyone seems surer and surer of their opinion on key complex issues, right?
True.
And so how to reflect on the underpinnings of that knowledge and what we should be certain about and what we should be less certain about, and not to question everything, but the right way to ask questions about what we should and shouldn't be sure about. I think philosophy is core to that. And then on the kind of the ethical side, right? So there's immense power in healthcare and immense complexity. And anytime there's a lot of complexity and power, you can't really trace back accountability. So there's this piece around how to act morally in such a complex environment, right? How to be responsible and accountable. It requires a kind of systems thinking, right? And I think in a lot of corporations, including at UCB, where we're training all of our leaders in multi-level systems thinking, to me, that's a philosophy enterprise.
Yeah.
Right. And so all of that helps. And it, of course, I'm clearly biased on this issue. Right. But I remember when I was in high school and we had a senior executive from Unilever come to give a careers talk. Right. And the memorable moment of the talk was his last slide was a table. in which on the left side, he listed all the potential careers that any of us had mentioned that we might be interested in going to. And he was going to reveal on the right-hand side of the table what we should study as an undergraduate to best prepare ourselves for that career.
Did you make the right choice?
Well, the punchline to his talk was that his answer was engineering for every career. It didn't matter what we chose. It was engineering, 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 engineering.
So there's the golden bullet, actually.
From his perspective, so I have my own biased version of that same table in which I put philosophy next to every career choice. I'm reading a fascinating book by Daniel Mendelsohn called An Odyssey. He's a classicist by training. His perspective is the classics is what everybody should study no matter what your career. But I think the issues I just mentioned are that it's not the technical knowledge that matters most, right? It's this way of thinking. And in this world, in this moment, complex, ambiguous, post-truth, post-fact, philosophy is, I find, an indispensable skill.
Yeah. And information can be found anywhere elsewhere in the World Wide Web, but the way to find it, the way to interpret it, and the way to use it is probably what counts most in these days. Yeah, so not the pure knowledge, but also what you do with it, and that goes back to
the
philosophical and ethical questions.
Yeah, what's the root of that? What even counts as knowledge as opposed to a belief or opinion? It's getting blurrier and blurrier, and it's not just mindfulness. It's a skill.
Yeah. A skill of filtering in the right way, I guess,
exactly.
And interpreting the right way.
Yeah.
Hey, and before we kind of look into the future, I just want to look once back in your previous life, because you started your career as an expedition volunteer at Raleigh International, mm-hmm. which is a global youth-driven organization that is dedicated to building a better and more sustainable world, according to their tagline. And you worked in Zimbabwe for a couple of months. How has this time, very early in your career, shaped kind of your career choices afterwards? And have you learned anything there that still until now still drives you today?
I really appreciate you asking the question, because it was a formative experience for me.
Okay.
And it was also... It was part of a pattern that I find recurring in my career. I'm not exactly sure yet the root cause of that pattern, but the pattern for me is a series of choices that are relatively predictable, make sense, right? Follow a linear path, and then all of a sudden do something quite different, right? So I had kind of gone through a route of spending my summers with friends at camp, right? In my adolescence, and then all of a sudden decided to do something totally different and go to Africa for a summer as a volunteer. And in my career, right, scientific and medical job, all of a sudden something totally different in global project leadership. And then a series of global roles in neurology, in leadership positions, then all of a sudden taking a job in access and pricing, which quite frankly, I knew very little about, right?
Yeah.
But became fascinated by, because our CEO was just asking amazing questions that were really thought-provoking in preparing for launch. And so that was not another left turn for me. And it's actually, I digress a bit, but it's a moment also to express gratitude for a company that would even allow someone without a deep training in access and pricing to take on a role like that. But it's I'm grateful for a company that has that trust of me. But back to your question, I learned some important things about myself. And perhaps the most important is I was not really as kind and empathetic a person as I thought I was, right?
Before you went there.
I had a pretty high opinion of myself, right?
Okay.
I was barely 20, I think, right?
To rule the world,
exactly.
Basically.
Yeah, that kind of youthful energy and... gung-ho confidence, right? But a bit of arrogance and hubris thrown in, probably. And I think the physical hardship of the situation, the surroundings we were in, the poverty that we saw, but also the diversity of people there that came from all kinds of backgrounds, privileged and very far from privileged. And so I just had experiences at a interpersonal level that made me realize I was not as kind-hearted or empathetic person as I thought. And so that kind of gave me the shot across the bow, I think, to course correct at least while there was still enough time to to further develop myself. So that was super important to me. And also just the capacity to be enlightened from surprising places, right? So, I mean, I grew up in a, I had the opportunity to go to, you know, a well-funded private school, mm-hmm. right? Surrounded by affluent, well-educated people. And so that now I was in this environment with all different kinds of people. And so it opened my eyes to what different people could bring to a project. Mm. Whether we were sitting around, you know, a fire in the evening talking about life, or whether we were having to design a shelter for an old people's home in a rural community in Zimbabwe, the skills I learned in my, you know, posh private school weren't going to get it done, right? So people brought to the table a lot of different perspectives. And so it just broadened my appreciation for where insight and enlightenment and values and value can come from. And so those are things that I think in terms of my value set are quite formative for me, not strictly work and career lessons, but just personal values.
So what I'm hearing is that it clearly kind of grounded you, gave you some characteristics that you haven't, that you didn't build until then, but also it helped you really getting problems solved that are present and pressing at the very moment, yeah, kind of sheltering an old people's home. You referenced earlier from normal life, hopefully we can preserve some of the singers on the balcony and the trumpet players on the street. In professional life and healthcare in particular, I would wish for preserving the appreciation and the trust building that happened during that time between the different healthcare stakeholders, because it has showcased to me what can be achieved if you pull jointly towards something, speeding up development cycles, speeding up approval cycles. Anything is possible if you work towards the same goal, it seemed. And this is what I would personally wish for, preserving from that pandemic for the healthcare industry. But probably also switching more towards the supply chain of pharma, and it actually did not collapse, luckily, in at least in big terms, even under the pressure of COVID. But the pandemic has revealed some serious weaknesses also in the pharma logistics. For instance, when China stopped their exports of personal protective equipment at the onset of the pandemic. With that in mind, how do you basically plan to properly strike the balance between optimizing the cost on the one hand, but also increasing the resilience of your supply chains on the other hand?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question. I think not just for biopharma, but this trade-off that you're alluding to between optimization and efficiency of supply chain versus the resilience or the anti-fragility of supply chain, I think it's going to become an emerging strategic choice that many companies have to make, because globalization and outsourcing have presented a lot of opportunities for super efficiency, right? And as you stretch that efficiency thinner and thinner, you lose your resilience, right? And how you manage that trade-off, which in turn requires a more sophisticated quantitative risk assessment, which is something we're working on here at UCB. But these are all the fundamental underpinnings of a company strategy. It's the kind of juicy trade-off that you want to get into as a strategist. It reminds me a bit of something I read a while ago, just an opportunity to mention a strange but compelling article I found. I think it was in HBR. And it was ostensibly about something totally different. It was about I think CEO signatures, right, and what it revealed about their personality. But what they were trying to do was correlate, right, the personality of the CEO with the long-term prosperity of the company.
Interesting.
Right, and what they realized is, well, the answers depended totally on what measure they used for prosperity of the company. And they ended up getting totally different results depending on whether they were looking at short-term growth or the ability of the company to stick around decade over decade, right? So their list of best performers that were still, you know, in the upper quadrant of their industry 20 years later versus the top 10 fastest risers in their sector, totally different groups of companies, right? And I link it to your question because you've basically got those that are trying to grow really fast but might not be the most resilient, right, versus those that might not be as efficient, might not be growing as fast, but they've got more resilience, right? And so they're going to stick around for longer. So what, in the end, what are you maximizing for, right? I think so. It's anyway. It's a I think an interesting trade-off, right? That there's a supply chain aspect, but also just a corporate strategy aspect.
And as you are the head of corporate strategy at UCB, you'll be also on spot, kind of forming that very future for UCB, and yeah, very much looking forward to seeing that over the years to come here.
Yeah, and I think indeed, I look forward to kind of tackling some of the issues, and I think there's some interesting aspects. One for biopharma overall, right? I mean, the first is industry margins are under a lot of scrutiny, right? But I think the question you're raising is an important point in defending why a reasonable margin is important, right? Because we're not talking about supply chain for denim, right? We're talking about supply chain of healthcare equipment and medicine. So you wouldn't want it to be uber lean and efficient. You want some resilience in it, and therefore there has to be some margin associated to create that buffer and that resilience. And I think probably some of the trade-offs are encapsulated in the strategy we have here, which is not unitary, right? It's blended based on where the product is in its life cycle, based on the population we're serving, based on which markets it's launched and available in. So we tend to adapt from single to multi-source, whether we're the only option for patient populations or not. There's not, I think, one answer. It requires a bit of understanding the needs of each population in each market.
Switching gears towards that very future of healthcare, and that was the original discussion that we had a couple of months back,
yes,
but also
yeah.
Kind of the underpinning pattern of the Strategy and Insider podcast around that future of health. We're currently redoing our flagship study there, and what we've seen is that there is an emergence of what we call a life care ecosystem that is constituting both a disease care cycle but also a well care cycle. Mm-hmm. And we do believe, and others as well actually, that this will fundamentally reshape the traditional biopharma business model. And by putting the human really at the center of that life care system, we see a true shift and also a convergence of the acute care, but also the well care setting. How, from your perspective, will those developments towards a more preventative and at the same time less curative medicine will affect the pharma industry as a whole? And secondly to that, how will the experience of patients, or merely people, in the well care cycle evolve from your perspective?
Mm. Yeah, this is another great question and a rich subject, I think, of worthy of reflection, right, for the whole industry. My personal view, I'm not sure I see prevention necessarily displacing cure, right? I do see the rise of focus on prevention and wellness, right? But I kind of see them both growing together, right?
As well.
Mm-hmm. And there's always going to be more to cure, right? I mean, just in a logical sense, right? Whatever you prevent will improve longevity, which will expose then that person or that segment of population to whatever's next, right?
Yeah, the next disease, yeah.
Yeah, until we figure out immortality, there's going to be something to cure, right? So, and I think you're alluding to that in terms of this cycle, right, where they go together. I think there are things that underpin both that become important, right? And certainly at UCB, it's very much top of our mind, right? So really getting to etiology and the root cause of disease, right? Whether you're interested in prevention or whether you're interested in moving from symptom treatment to disease modification and freedom from disease, you have to understand etiology. But etiology has to be understood at a, and this is maybe where the prevention and societal piece comes in, has to be understood not just at a biologic level, but at a social level in terms of social determinants, right? So if you really want to understand what's the cause of a patient being in not the cause of them having a set of symptoms, but the cause of them being in a situation, right? Then you've got the social factors and the biological factors that led them to be where they are. And so understanding all of the root causes, the biologic ones and the social ones, becomes really important, whether you want to prevent or whether you want to cure. And so I think, there's, you know, doors that open up opportunities for big data and AI to better understand that etiology. There's probably also opportunity around some better goal alignment, as we alluded to before, between public and private interests. And also, I think, and this is of personal fascination to me, the human psychology aspect, right? I mean, I think it's probably more trendy to call it behavioral economics, but to me, it's human psychology. But, you know, the art of nudging and understanding personal biases, cognitive biases, and how to influence people. I mean, these are major drivers of social change, right? And behavioral change. And if we want to understand, it's highly relevant in prevention, right? Because prevention is not just a kind of biomedical aspect. It's a behavioral and social piece too. But I think it all comes together, right? Whether you're trying to tackle the etiology of the disease or work on prevention, the real underpinnings of how the biology and the social context come together become really important. I also wanted to add a couple other comments if I can, because I think they're timely. One is, I really hope, I don't know how confident I am, but I really hope this move towards prevention can be rolled out more equitably than we roll out symptom treatment and cure. I'm not sure the early days of vaccine deployment globally are a great signal for that. But
surely not.
Where there's a will, there's a way. So I think that will become important. And then I read recently, I don't know how credible the sources, but I'd read that it's not always the case that prevention is more cost effective than treatment. And it caught my attention, not to kind of challenge the premise of your question, but because when I think about the question, I immediately assume prevention, good thing, right? Be much more cost effective, better for everybody. But there's a case study in tuberculosis where it's been shown that it's more cost effective to treat than to prevent. Right, so I think it's just a small caveat to say, rather than jumping all into, okay, this is the next exciting thing, right? It's more, in certain cases, it makes much more sense, right? Certainly, it's more cost effective to prevent lung cancer from smoking than it is to treat the lung cancer, yeah. Right? But there are other cases where it's not necessarily the case. So it's a complex issue. Yeah. And I'm fascinated to see how it unfolds. But I think there are common routes between prevention and treatment.
And I'm totally with you that it might not always be cost effective, but part of that equation also obviously needs to be the well-being of the patient and the quality of that life. Yeah, be it prevented or be it under treatment. And clearly, it needs to be looked in kind of in sync of all of that. But I'm with you. Prevention is probably not the holy grail to everything, and it needs to be cost effective. Hopefully, and I do share that perspective, we will be more able to equitably kind of spread that globally than medications. Hopefully, it's less heavy on logistical and supply chain issues, because there is clearly some problems bringing medicines to the world. Yeah, in every angle of the world, probably it's better doable with preventative measures. That's at least my dear hope.
It is, and I'm probably biased by my former hat, right? Before this role, working in access and pricing, because I mean, at UCB, we've put a lot into understanding the appropriate ways to value medicines, right? And from that work, the realization is we still haven't really even mastered the right way to holistically value treatment of complex symptomatology, let alone value cure, let alone properly value prevention, right? So underlying the economics of all of this is, what is prevention worth, right? What is society willing to pay for it, right? And that's another fascinating question that I think will deeply influence how this trend plays out.
And we could go on only on this topic for another hour, I assume, right? Yeah. But you mentioned something interesting. You referenced it as the rise of big data and AI. And I do believe that the discovery, the development, but also the surveillance post-marketing of a pharma product will require an ever-increasing amount of data that needs to be captured, cleansed, integrated, and also interpreted. How are you as a company strengthening, but also streamlining your data and the information management process to basically prepare for the increasing complexity that will surely come in the coming years?
Yeah, so we're doing a few, I think, of the the solid right basic things, right, to manage complexity, right? So we've relatively recently set up a data office and have a chief data officer so that we can work efficiently and transversely across all of the different facets of the company in which data and digitization play a role. I also think, or I know as a company, I like the credo that we have, where it's not just about automating our core processes as much as we can. So for example, in benefit risk decisions, within, you know, safety and development, there's a lot of automation of processes there. But the automation is not just for efficiency and to manage complexity, it's to also allow humans to focus on the stuff that humans are uniquely good at, right? So we're increasingly seeking to include patients in complex benefit risk decisions, right? And the time and space to do that is created by the ability to use digital techniques to automate the stuff that frees up human space and time. There's also a great opportunity that we're trying to capitalize to not just gather data through, I don't want to call RWE traditional at this point, but, you know, mainstream ways, RWE, past studies, things like that. But there's also the opportunity that we're trying to capitalize more on, which is in every routine patient interaction, every time the patient touches our medicine, right? Yeah. Every time they go to a pharmacy to pick up a prescription, there's an opportunity to learn something, right? If they call us for one reason with one question, there's an opportunity to ask them another. And certainly it's a regulated environment and there are limits, but there's a huge opportunity that I think a company like UCB that's deeply invested in understanding the patient can capitalize on in getting information there. But there's also another key aspect for us, which is we're never going to be the world-leading company in digital and data technology. We're a biopharma company. That's our core business and our strength. So we're seeking to partner in the right with the right companies at the right moment in the right domains where they have the tech leadership. So we have a relatively new collaboration with Microsoft, in which, in particular for biology and chemistry data sets, where it's high dimensional, unstructured data, and they have the kind of the cloud capacity and the AI to help us navigate those data sets and look for new candidates and new targets. And so for me, that's a good match between our strength in patient insight-driven R&D and their strength on the cloud AI side of managing unstructured data makes more sense than us trying to be masters of that universe ourselves.
And glad that you mentioned the kind of the tech players and media currently is full of examples that are popping up. Take Amazon Care spreading across the US market and then delivering their services also for other companies, innovating Alexa together, also now kind of bringing healthcare and elderly care back into the homes. Take Apple together with Biogen, UCLA, University of College of California, trying to detect biomarkers in neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's, which is also part of your remit, and also Parkinson's. But also take Google's DeepMind that via AlphaFold recently founded a for-profit company that really goes into innovating pharma R&D, which is at the very core of the pharma business model, innovating new drugs based on algorithms that they innovated via their AlphaFold technology and service. With that said, and you referencing that you're partnering with companies such as Microsoft, ultimately, how do you perceive these tech players? Would you rather perceive them as kind of welcomed collaboration partners? Or is it more that they are ultimately kind of a threat to traditional healthcare companies and someone who will disrupt the sector for the next years?
Yeah, it's... I don't want it to seem like a cop-out answer, but my answer is yes. I see them as an opportunity and I see them as a threat, right? Yeah. It's in terms of disruption, right? So I think the cycle, the cycle's been evolving and maybe many years back, the consensus opinion was opportunity, right? And then kind of there was this kind of swing towards maybe there's a threat, and there was kind of the kind of a peak and a crescendo of tech interest in health. And I think now the pendulum's come back to more of a midpoint where the answer's more nuanced, right? I think we're getting to an era of smarter partnerships, right? Where it's not just any tech company and any healthcare company, but matching the right capabilities. And that's core of our strategy at UCB too, right? Where are we credible, legitimate as leaders? Whereas a tech company got the right technology, where did they have something no one else has? And how does that fit with the need of a particular patient population? It's not one size fits all. And so based on who has the unique capabilities, unlocking something, I think that becomes an opportunity. I think there are examples, for example, if we talk about stratification and prediction, right? There may be disruption as technology changes where and how key decisions are made about which prescription a patient is given, right? So the decision-making authority of the physician, but also the reimbursement analyses of payers. But equally, that disruptive influence is highly likely, I think, to amplify the value of existing and new medicines, right? By better illuminating for which patients it creates the most value. So even on a single issue like stratification of response, you can see disruption because of, let's say, disintermediation of physician, right? Which would itself kind of certainly significantly change the healthcare model for biopharma. But clearer demonstration of value is a boon to something we've been struggling with for a long time. So that's why I think the answer is not cut and dried. In terms of the application of AI in R&D, I would say mostly to date, it's been augmentation rather than disruption, right? I mean, a lot of what we're doing is AI driven in, whether it be in protein folding or understanding key targets. Maybe it's naive to think, but moving from the AI piece, right? So understanding the nature of the target or designing an antibody or molecule to actually putting it in the lab, doing the early wet research, the translational medicine, the early development, I still see more opportunity than I see threat, right? I don't want to say I'm not dismissive of the threat. I think it's real in terms of its disruptive potential. But if I try to make a kind of balanced equation of the upside for us versus the downside for us, I see more upside. I see more partnership upside than I see business encroachment.
And I'm with you. Ultimately, there is a lot of upside for us as humans and society. Time will tell how well these partnerships will play out. And in my eyes, how much you come together on a really eye-to-eye level as a pharma company with the immensely big tech players together, yes, with universities, university clinics, regulators. In my eyes, this is where really innovation will happen eventually going forward. And, yeah, and these perspectives need to be coming together, however, on really an eye-to-eye level. And yeah, everyone is kind of having the same ticket to the party. Yeah, yeah. And really come together like-minded. And yeah, that would be, to me, the trick of really innovating for the good.
I think a couple of other interesting aspects will be, one, it will be a real test of how well companies know themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Because to kind of fulfill what I mentioned, where I still think there's more opportunity than threat, the partnerships have to be based on, let's say UCB's case, right? Us playing where we have true competitive advantage, where we're really strong, right? And have something that others can't offer, right? Which requires us to see ourselves clearly, mm-hmm, right? And if we're wrong about that, if there's hubris in that evaluation, right? If we love ourselves too much and we think that we've got something that no one else can offer, but it turns out a tech company can end run around it or find another partner, then there's a real threat. But if we're really disciplined in our strategy and understand clearly, right, where we can do things that others can't, right, where there would be a long and difficult barrier for them to acquire the same capabilities, then I think we have a kind of core business to hold on to and a really attractive kind of set of partnership models. The other thing that I think is interesting is whether AI will kind of jump the next hurdle with ease in terms of, and I think healthcare is a great example of this. So still most of the data that AI algorithms are crunching is kind of laid out in a fairly kind of linear way, right? I mean, the data may be more or less structured, but it's just tabulated data sets, right? I think a lot of the advancement in healthcare, especially if we go back to our prior conversation about etiology and understanding root causes and advances in really how we understand medicine, right? State of the art in representing that kind of information is knowledge is in graph, right? With yeah. edges and vertices and nodes and in kind of that graph theory network. And that AI hasn't quite mastered, you know, how to train algorithms and optimize predictions and discoveries on that kind of data. So I think that's kind of the next frontier for healthcare, is to see whether AI is capable of that. Again, a bit of a bias I have. I think a lot of the advancement in AI over the last couple of decades is based on data density and computational power. The core nature of the algorithms, at least I'm not an expert, but to my eyes, hasn't changed radically since, you know, 1970s. But it would need to kind of jump that next hurdle in terms of moving healthcare into kind of really tackling etiology and prevention.
And Ben, during the last episode, also referenced that you can only train the AI to be a powerful AI if you have the right data set to train them on. Yeah? Only if there is enough wet biology data, then eventually you can read patterns into that data. Looking at those tech players that we just referenced now, and kind of you referencing them as, hopefully welcome collaboration partners and fruitful collaborations spinning off from that, but at the same time also disruptors and kind of a threat to traditional healthcare companies. If there would be one characteristic you as a pharma company, as UCB, could borrow from those big tech players, what would that be in your eyes?
So I think, sorry to be evasive, but I think the, for me, it's there's not one, right? Our strategy is more really looking at it in a different way, which is each population is unique. What they need is unique, and each tech player brings something different to that game. So it's a mix and match strategy, right? So rather than taking one characteristic from a tech company, it's about in this population, right, what would best complement our medicine and further unlock a unique outcome for that patient. And the answer is going to be different in a Parkinson's population, in an epilepsy population, in a psoriasis or rheumatoid arthritis population, for example, right? Yeah, it's a mix and match for us, and it's a realization in the premise of your question, which I agree with, they bring a lot to the table that we don't have, right? So we have a good example recently where we developed some work in fracture detection to aid fracture prevention ultimately. So we have a tool called BoneBot, which we've now worked with Image Biopsy Lab to further develop, because they're the ones that have the tech capacity mm-hmm. to take it on, right? So they have characteristics that we don't have, right? But I don't want to borrow their expertise in that technology, right? I want to work, because their expertise honestly is not going to help our patients in psoriasis that much, right? A different company will have tools that come to bear. But I have a slightly cheeky answer for you if you push me to say to take one characteristic from a tech company.
I would have asked for that, actually.
Yeah, if you're pushing for one, then the characteristic I'll take from either Apple or Amazon is cash on hand.
Cash on hand, okay. but that's a good one. No one can deny that, actually, I guess, right? But ultimately, it boils down also, you need to know yourself as a company very well, but you also need to stay true to the capabilities of your company that you bring and not try to bend too much, but also openly collaborate and ask for collaboration help from others that are much better in some of those disciplines needed to advance the future of health. James, what a rich dialogue and clear perspectives that you brought. Really big thanks for shedding light here, for you personally, but also for UCB as a company. I truly enjoyed the dialogue that we just had. And by now, I do understand what you mean by you being a scientist by training, but a philosopher at heart. So with that said, really big thanks. I truly enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too. Thanks for the opportunity.
So what a great start into the new year 2022. Thanks a lot for listening in. I hope you really enjoyed it as much as I did. And I'm already looking forward to upcoming episodes also this year. However, until then, stay tuned and most importantly, stay safe and take care. Bye-bye.
Strategy and strategy made real.